Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
A betrayal narrative emerged during the 1980s and the 1990s, running that we weren't defeated by the Vietnamese, we were defeated by liberals in Congress, radicals in the streets.
Scholar and Vietnam War veteran Jerry Lemke joins us to talk about propaganda, myths, and war from Vietnam to Iraq and Afghanistan. Jerry Lemke is a professor of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross. His 2010 book about actress Jane Fonda is titled Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. His previous book was Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam.
This betrayal narrative has a lot of paranoia, a lot of conspiracist themes running through it.
Since the 2004 Swift Boat propaganda campaign against then-presidential candidate John Kerry, a Vietnam veteran, U.S. political campaigns have seemed more like a review of the Vietnam War than current Iraq and Afghan war policy. The glaring absence of real debate about America's ongoing trillion-dollar wars has left a void that the political right wing has been stepping into just ahead of the 2010 congressional races.
I always say about this, the important thing is, if these people could have killed 30,000 or 300,000, they would have.
Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, for example, has been in the US, boosting fear and anger just ahead of the September 11th anniversary, making appearances on PBS and ABC. He's reframing political discourse about Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran, forming them into an old-fashioned Cold War-era battle against Islamic extremism.
What I understood less clearly at that time was how deep this ideological movement is. This is actually more like the phenomenon of revolutionary communism. It's the religious or cultural equivalent of it. And its roots are deep, its tentacles are long, and its narrative about Islam stretches far further than we think.
Tony Blair arguing, too, that if he were still in office, he would likely attack Iran.
I'm not taking any option off the table.
So you see a military possibility against Iran?
I don't want to see it.
But you're saying it has to happen.
I don't want to see it, but I'm saying you cannot exclude it.
The cost of war against Iran today would be immeasurable, would likely kill millions, according to global security experts. So we decided to review an era when the U.S. military draft pulled in a lot of different kinds of Americans, many of whom were skeptical and would eventually become peace activists like Jerry Lemke. Just to review the cost of the Vietnam War, 58,159 U.S. military personnel were killed. Over 303,000 were wounded. Many suffered in Indochinese POW camps. 4 million Indochinese civilians perished during saturation bombing by U.S. forces and in ground warfare. Jerry Lemke has been trying to set the record straight, too, about this era. He's been exposing lies about U.S. soldiers being spat upon as they returned home, blame levied at the peace movement rather than at the architects of the Vietnam War itself, a rewriting of history to adjust attention away from grotesque U.S. policy blunders and military atrocities. Jerry Lemke, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Just tell us about your background first, as an introduction to who you are and some of the reasons that you thought it was important to write this book.
I grew up in a small town in northwest Iowa, very small town, 300 people, went to the local public high school there, played baseball, played basketball, went to Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where I majored in math, played some more baseball. First job out of college was teaching math, junior high school math in Fort Dodge, Iowa. I got drafted in the spring of 1968 after the Tet Offensive when the Johnson administration reached a little deeper into the pool and got people like me who had been deferred first for college and then occupationally. And I was 25 then when I got drafted. There were several school teachers in Iowa and I think across the country who got drafted. Went to basic training in Fort Lewis, Washington, and at the end of basic training was invited to volunteer to go to chaplain's assistant school, which at that time was in Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn, New York, and went there. And that was really the beginning of my political education. That was a very raucous time in New York City, summer, fall of 1968. And I think encountered my first anti-war activists at that time. They were trying to recruit us, of course, to the anti-war movement, but also just reaching out in a spirit of mutuality to us. Saw my first anti-war demonstration, actually, on the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, and that was a very growing moment for me. I'm on one side of the street, and I'm looking at these protesters on the other side and thinking, they know something, I don't know, what is it? And I began to read. I went from New York City in the fall then of 68, got to Vietnam around New Year's Day of 1969, took a bunch of books with me from New York City. And that kind of was re-education or extended education for me. Was assigned to an artillery unit in Vietnam in the Central Highlands, 41st Artillery Group, and one of my chaplains that I worked for was also opposed to the war. He was instrumental also in helping me to come to consciousness, so to speak, about the war. And then after Vietnam, I joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and off and on active, but committed to anti-war politics from that time on.
Jerry Lemke, we don't talk much about the kinds of choices that people have made over times when they've entered the military. And in a recent Frontline special on the soldier's heart, we heard a chaplain explain that, you know, there are wars in the Bible, that killing in war is okay, essentially, and that then we have to make sure that soldiers know that where they may kill someone once they've come back home from war, now that's a sin.
The chaplain's cover for the dilemma that you're laying out there is render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And their interpretation of that is that military service that is lawful is what Caesar has a right to ask of us, and we are obligated to render that service. I sat in on some counseling sessions in Vietnam, and oftentimes they were soldiers who were having family problems at home or disciplinary problems in the military, not always related to their opposition to the war, but whenever the opposition to killing would come up, you know, kind of moral, ethical qualms about the war, it was always the render unto Caesar line that was delivered. And in order to get out of Vietnam, you know, for reasons of conscientious objection, the chaplain was one of the steps along the way. A soldier would have to talk to the chaplain and get the chaplain to take his case to higher command and in order to get out, or even to get a leave for family reasons or things like that. In the 13 months I was in Vietnam, I never heard the chaplain once, any of my chaplains. I worked for three primarily while I was there, and I never heard once any of them take any of the soldiers' cases beyond that counseling session. It was always the mission of the chaplain seemed to always be to counsel these guys back into their role in Vietnam. I have only a vaguest sense of today that it's no different. I did have a conversation with a chaplain who called me about my book, somebody I'd never met. He's still in service. He was just back then from either Afghanistan or Iraq, and he was troubled by some of the things that I write. My opposition to the war, he was thoughtful about it and very civil about it, and we've talked two or three times and promised to stay in touch and talk more, but you know, he's very committed to the mission and sees his role as chaplain to be within those parameters, the military mission.
Well, turning to your book now, Hanoi Jane, on page 107, you mentioned the Buffalo Springfield song, For What It's Worth. This song kind of representative of the Vietnam War years and lyrics that were representative of a kind of growing, morphing paranoia.
The war in Vietnam was lost. That's the really big picture, the really big story. It was a hard pill to swallow for lots of Americans. America turned inward, or a good part of American political culture turned inward, looking for scapegoats for the loss of the war. A betrayal narrative emerged during the 1980s and the 1990s, running that we weren't defeated by the Vietnamese, we were defeated by liberals in Congress, radicals in the streets. This betrayal narrative has a lot of paranoia, a lot of conspiracist sort of themes running through it. I mean, the idea, after all, that somebody behind the line, behind your own line, somebody behind your back, really cost you that victory, was compelling. I mean, it was persuasive for a lot of people. A lot of GIs came home from the war in Vietnam opposed to the war. A lot of people, like myself, joined the anti-war movement. Most GIs came home and went back to work, went back to school, went back to their families, and weren't political. But I think that to the extent that Vietnam veterans were political, the vast, you know, majority, the bulk of that political activity was opposed to the war. But then as years went by, that kind of eroded. You know, if you were kind of survey the scene today, I think things have really shifted. And I think one reason why is that a lot of Vietnam veterans, as time went by, kind of got wooed by this conspiracist, paranoid line that was coming from right-wing America. Now, why is that? One of the reasons why is that we also came back from Vietnam with our own touch of paranoia, much of which was due to the military culture, the in-service military culture. The fact that the war itself was a war for hearts and minds, that became almost a trope for Americans to understand what the war was about during those years. It was a war, a psychological war, a psyops war that was waged against the enemy. A lot of assumptions made by the American military planners and the strategists was that the communists on the other side were waging their own psychological operations, war. We were all subject to being brainwashed, and so forth. And so there was a lot of internal paranoia within the military. Military officers were very paranoid themselves about the enlisted men who might pick up a gun and shoot them. There was something called fraggings, attacks on military officers. But even way short of that, there was just a fear that some younger people within the military, draftees like me, you know, might be persuaded by the anti-war line. The officers were always looking for signs of our own opposition and coming down on that, monitoring us rather closely and in ways that made us very suspicious of the military. So I think a lot of people, a lot of GIs returned to the States, a lot of Vietnam veterans came back to the States kind of jumpy, not just of the war itself, but because of military culture. That fear that somebody is looking over their shoulder, that fear that authority figures are not really working in their own interest. The drug culture, too, I write a little bit about in the book, comes with a certain amount of paranoia. I mean, it's almost a kind of a cultural attribute, or it was then anyway, of people who smoked a lot of pot. In Vietnam, that was against the rules, so there was a kind of looking over the shoulder for that reason, too. And then back home, of course, there was Vietnam Veterans Against the War was infiltrated by the Nixon administration, agent provocateurs within the movement. And there was a lot of that going on within the anti-war movement, too, more broadly within the country. So that's really what I'm about in that section of the book.
And you're writing really about how the tour that Jane Fonda took of North Vietnam was folded into this rhetoric about the enemy and about, you know, what we are up against here in America. At the time, of course, as you say, we were still really involved in this military arms race with the Soviet Union, and China was our enemy. So America's wealth was getting pumped into the war. And so there were many, many people keeping that going well into, you know, beyond Vietnam.
Sure.
But how do you think it was that, you know, that jump got made, you know, for soldiers who may have been enraged at their command for sending them places again and again after what they thought was a hopeless endeavor to begin with? You know, we get this picture of Hamburger Hill type scenarios. Mm-hmm. But then ultimately the anger being deflected onto the, quote, anti-war movement, which I guess you could say was a scapegoat for the military's sense of despair and defeat.
Sure. Sure, it was scapegoating. It was an alibi, the alibi running that we were defeated by people like Jane Fonda, who went to Hanoi in 1972 as a peace activist. I think the touchstone for that one probably is the broadcast, radio broadcast, that she made from Hanoi, in which it later was alleged that she demoralized soldiers still fighting in the South, that she demoralized the fighter pilots flying off the aircraft carriers in the South China Sea, that they heard these broadcasts, and it was, you know, demoralizing to think that this attractive American activist was in the enemy capital, you know, literally behind the lines there, and doing things, you know, that would undermine the chance of success. There were a lot of other people who went to Hanoi, and I write a lot about that in the book, too, and the importance of that, and why it is that Jane Fonda gets singled out, you know, as the scapegoat. And part of that has to do with gender, the fact that she is a woman, and the sexual imagery of Jane Fonda from that time.
I'm wondering if maybe that was not some of the base reason for the anger and rage that she had been posing as a sex symbol, in which case now she's being revealed as something else. So
yes,
those who invested in her as a sex symbol were troubled, but also the idea that she could be both sexually attractive and also bright enough to do something that might affect history, maybe threatened people.
Absolutely. Although what I do in this book is try to make the case that the sexualizing of Jane Fonda is part of the mythologizing of her as Hanoi Jane. To use your words, that she was a sex symbol, you know, before she came out as an anti-war activist, I think that that's a bit of cultural revisionism in itself. The basis for that sex symbol identity is the film Barbarella, and that's documentable. The people who write about Fonda as a sex symbol always refer to Barbarella. So I went back and I looked at the film Barbarella 17 times, 18th time just last week again, to see what it was. Because here's the thing, when I was in Vietnam in 1969, I don't think I even knew who Jane Fonda was. There are people who have written about Jane Fonda as a pinup for GIs in Vietnam. And when I read that, when I read those things, I said, wait a minute, that's not true. Jane Fonda was never a pinup. So I've done a little bit of research besides my own memory, which is not very reliable for something like this, you know, to try to clarify in my own mind. And as well as I've been able to do that, I think my instinct was right. She was not a pinup. The film Barbarella has a very complex sexuality to it. There's a lot of androgyny in the film Barbarella. There's a lot of bisexuality. There is some homosexuality in the film Barbarella. In the course of working on the book, one sociologist friend of mine said, oh, Barbarella, that's popular again, kind of a lesbian cult classic. And I thought, aha, if that's the sexuality of Barbarella, then that in itself would be kind of evidence that she was not a conventional sex symbol in 1968, 1969, 1970. So that had to be constructed over the years. That becomes part of setting her up on a pedestal, right, as this sex symbol, that kind of bubble-headed sex symbol that then gets knocked down. So I write quite a bit about that in the book. I have a whole chapter, actually, on Barbarella in the book. And so I think that the sexuality then that is important, I think, is the warrior woman sexuality, the warrior woman identity, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are maybe thinking when I say warrior woman, Wonder Woman, and all of that kind of imagery is very complex, sexually speaking. And I think that is the problem. I think a lot of people who have a problem with Jane Fonda and the sexuality of Jane Fonda, I think it's actually a problem with that sexuality as I'm talking about it now. Not the sex symbol who betrays that heterosexual sex kitten kind of imagery, but whose figure all along challenges conventional, certainly conventional, senses of masculinity and femininity. And I go a bit into some of other Fonda's other films, too, particularly throughout the 70s, films like Clute and Coming Home and Julia. If you rewatch all of those films, you get a very sense of the sexual messages that Fonda is sending in her films during those years.
She was also breaking new ground in other ways in other theater. And I want to ask you about that, because it's distinctly different from, let's say, Barbarella, that she was part of this little touring group, FTA. So just describe what FTA was. I know it involved Donald Sutherland.
Yeah, Donald Sutherland, Jules Pfeiffer, the cartoonist, writer, Holly Near, and other people. They put together this kind of anti-Bob Hope show. Bob Hope, for many years, toured a variety show around military bases with music and attractive Hollywood starlets to entertain the troops. I think it went back to World War II, actually. So through Korea, through Vietnam, and even after Vietnam, he did this. So Jane Fonda and others came up with this idea of, let's do a Bob Hope-type show, but one with an anti-military and anti-war flavor to it. And so they did. So it was a show that featured music, of course, and featured skits. Send-ups more of military authority than the war in Vietnam. The title of it, FTA, stood for Fun, Travel, and Adventure by one interpretation, Free the Army by another interpretation, and simply F the Army by still another interpretation. So it had this kind of double, triple entendre in the title that was a lot of fun itself and got used in a lot of different ways. So they toured. They would not get onto military bases, but they would play at sites nearby to military bases and draw GIs off base for these performances. And they toured around Asia, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines. They never got into Vietnam. I guess the military was able to stop them from doing that. But they were very popular and important for helping to politicize a lot of military people, a lot of draftees, people like myself. And then it was made into a film. Well, they filmed themselves on tour and then turned that into a tour film. And that was around for a while and has recently been re-released on DVD, so listeners can get that. And that's a real period piece. You see Donald Sutherland in very different guise than some people would know him today, and Jane Fonda. There's clips of it, by the way, in the film DVD Sir, No Sir, that came out in 2006. Jane Fonda is in that film as a character in FTA, and then also in her more present-day oppositions to the wars that are going on now.
Well, I think the one part of that that is so fascinating has to do with former President Richard Nixon, as he is having a, you know, discussion supposedly with Pat, his wife, and they're discussing who's at the steps protesting now. And he's saying, oh, don't worry, we'll just get the military to come out and shut them down. And of course, she says, it is the military.
The Marines are the protesters. Yes, I reproduce that piece of the script in my book. I think it's really funny.
Well, it also brings up another question I have for you, Jerry Lemke. And this is about what the military does to convince us, win our hearts and minds over about wars, and how that becomes part of the popular culture. Because I know that's a big theme in this book, of how people are cultivated into a belief system and who does the cultivating.
I don't think it's changed too much since the Vietnam War years. I mean, the complicity of the news media, the complicity of Hollywood filmmakers is very important. The extent to which the wars themselves are displaced from the screen, we're getting some correction to that. I thought the film Hurt Locker was a great film for the way it portrayed the war. I know there are questions about some of the authenticity of the scenes, but we didn't get much of that type of film during the Vietnam War years. What we get a lot of then, and still get a lot of today, is stories about the men who fight the war, about veterans back home after the war. Some of the really good ones that have come out recently, well, good, I put that in quote. I don't particularly like these films, but good examples of that are the film Jarhead, for example, the film Brothers. These are ways in which the American people are sort of brought into themes about the war, but the war itself stays off screen, and the enemy certainly stays off screen. Some of these films from Vietnam, like Coming Home, would be an example of that. We never see the enemy that we were there to fight, or if we do, see them in very racialized and stereotypical kinds of ways. And for the most part, that's still true today. There's a lot of mingling together of sex and violence in films. I probably know those best from films of the Vietnam War years. There's a lot of inaccuracies in those kinds of portrayals, a lot of disparagement, I think, of American men and American soldiers.
And of course, you bring in "Johnny got his gun." These are the famous words about an anti-war soldier, someone who's reflecting back and explaining that we were farmers before you sent us to war, remember? You know, and pointing out who the really culpable people are, in a way, the people who started the war.
Those words are from the Dalton Trumbo book, and they're also repeated by Donald Sutherland in the film FTA. And I read Dalton Trumbo's book soon after I came home from Vietnam, and oh my God, I mean, even as I speak about it now, I feel chills on my spine, and I don't know if people read that anymore. I don't hear about it anyway, being in the college curriculum, and it, you know, it needs to be put back in. Such a powerful read. But the point of those words, I think, as Trumbull wrote those, is that, you know, we the farmers, we the workers, we are going to wise up. And when we do, those of you who wish to make war are going to be sorry that you put the guns in our hands, because we can and we will turn those guns around. You got to hear Donald Sutherland read those words. That is just a showstopper from FTA. But I don't know where we are with that now. Dalton Trumbo wrote those words just before World War II, and then they resonated certainly with the Vietnam era of activists, and a lot of the anti-imperialist thread of the movement, of the anti-war movement during those years, I think was premised on the idea that not only are people not going to fight these wars, but we're going to fight the people who do want to fight these wars. That's kind of gotten lost, and I don't know. I think it's worth giving some thought to why that got lost, where, when it got lost, and how we can bring that back into the movement. A greater sense of militancy, not necessarily violence, but, you know, a more militant approach to opposing war than what we've seen in recent years.
He didn't just come home, right? He came home after the war, and the military took everything from him except his voice. And that's interesting, because he couldn't speak. And so he could only use Morse code, tapping it out with no limbs, no face, nothing.
Right.
It's just, it's sort of the force of anti-war sentiment symbolized by this person who was so disabled by the war itself that he couldn't communicate except by great effort, right?
Right.
So it's like, you know, we have to be his voice.
They took his body, but they didn't take his mind. And that's really interesting, because today we're very focused on PTSD and focused on what war does to the mind. And I think that Johnny got his gun, that's very different, right? There's nothing wrong with this guy's mind. He sees things very clearly. And some Vietnam veterans saw things very clearly, too, after the war. Somehow things have gotten more complicated or complicating now. And, you know, maybe Johnny got his gun, there's a clarity there that we need to get back to.
Jerry Lemke is professor of sociology at the College of Holy Cross. His 2010 book by University of Massachusetts Press about actress Jane Fonda is titled Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. His previous book was Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com. Our music is by Fritz Heed. Underwriting for the program was brought to you by JeremyRHammond.com, political analysis from outside the standard framework. He is founder and editor of ForeignPolicyJournal.com and a recipient of the Project Censored 2010 Award. New at JeremyRHammond.com, the story Turning Back from the Point of No Return, Implications of the Threat to Bomb Iran. He wrote it to counter the public narrative arguing that an airstrike on Iran might be necessary to prevent a nuclear holocaust.